Welcome to a new episode of the Society for Scholarly Publishing's Early Career Podcast. I'm Meredith, and I'm here with my co-host, Sarah. As always, we want to start by thanking SSP for giving us the opportunity to be here. In today's episode, we're continuing our primer series, which introduces our audience to some of the foundational topics, roles, and functions within our industry. For this primer about the world of university press publishing, we're happy to be joined by Don Durante, who is the Wyndham Robertson Editorial Director for the University of North Carolina Press. Dawn has an incredibly interesting role at UNC Press, and we'll hear more about that in a moment. She has also held previous roles at the University of Texas Press, the University of Illinois Press, and the University of Arizona Press. So needless to say, Dawn has a lot of rich experience in the university press world, and we're lucky to have her here to have this conversation with us and help us understand the fundamentals of this part of our industry. With that, let's start the conversation by getting a proper introduction to Dawn. Dawn, welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm really honored about the invitation, and I'm excited to speak with you today.
Great. So let's get started then by just having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey in the university press world.
Thank you so much. When I was an early career editor, I once read that publishing is an accidental profession. And while I think that has wildly changed now, people applying are very intentional about it, I think I found it a bit accidentally as well. I was an undergraduate at University of Arizona. I was an English major, a classics minor. I didn't know what I was going to do when I graduated. And all of a sudden, across the English department listserv, a call for an intern at University of Arizona Press came up. I applied, I got it, and it was in the acquisitions department, and my mind was just blown. There was a career where you could read and be a student forever, learning from scholars, the smartest people at what they do. And you could also be on the ground talking to those folks and being at conferences. And it really appealed two parts of my personality, the reader and the socializer. So how to get into university press publishing after that was a little bit more of a road. I ended up going to Arizona State University to do a master's degree, and they had a scholarly publishing certificate program. So I was taking classes where our guest lecturers were freelance indexers. And as part of that, I had the opportunity to do another internship. Ended up being at Cluj University Press in Romania, which was very different from the university presses I'm familiar with here in the States, and very interesting experience. After I finished that program, I actually spent a full year, almost exactly a year between my graduation date to the point of having my first interview. I was applying for assistant jobs, editor jobs, and I got an interview at University of Illinois Press for an assistant editor position. I took the position. I moved to Champaign-Urbana, and I was there for 9 years, promoted from assistant to acquisitions editor and then senior editor. By the time I left, I had worked on about 12 different series, including starting two new series. I had a lot of experience in acquisitions and a variety of topics. And I really felt the Association of University Presses was such a strong community. And so that was one of the ways I felt really connected to pursuing a professional trajectory within the university press world. I was editor-in-chief at University of Texas Press after my time at Illinois for 2 years. It was a great press. I had a wonderful time during my management and acquisitions opportunities there. And then a position opened up at UNC Press. I applied, I got it, and I joined as assistant editorial director. And then earlier this spring, I accepted the role of Wyndham Robertson Editorial Director. And I did want to mention that one of the things that has helped my mobility, I have had the privilege that a partner has worked remotely, and also one of the reasons that we ended up here in North Carolina at UNC Press was the pairing of this wonderful professional opportunity at UNC Press and also a personal one because we had some family here. And I think that's one of the things I have observed in a lot of professional decisions is the possibilities of those two things colliding. So I feel very fortunate for both my personal and professional trajectories here.
Thank you for that, Dawn. I think that's going to be really interesting for our audience to hear about the different steps that you took. And it's super relatable that you weren't exactly sure where you wanted to go and then ended up somewhere that felt like home and kind of built your career from there. So I feel like that will be super interesting for people to hear about. So let's get into the meat of the conversation. If you could start by just telling us a little bit about what you see as sort of the primary models that exist within a university press.
I don't see one definitive model for university presses. I think that's some of the ways in which the university press industry is so exciting. But I will say that foundationally, university presses are nonprofit, mission-driven publishers that really aim to serve both scholarly and regional communities. One core part of being a university press is that in order to be a member of the Association of University Presses, the university press must have a governing board. These are sometimes called press board, faculty board. Here at UNC Press, we call them board of governors. That board, whatever it's called, has essentially the same function, which is to oversee the peer review process and make sure that each book has been reviewed by the standard of the press. That board also approves new series and new journals for presses that publish journals. And these boards are essentially the stewards of the university press's imprint. They're an important network between the press and the press's home institution. And board members can be very powerful partners in advancing the goals of the editorial program. Sometimes they do really big things like advocate for the press with their home institutions, consult with us on new areas to publish, or it can be as simple as suggesting to one of their colleagues or students to consider the press as a home for their book and encourage them to submit a proposal. So that is one of the core features of any member of the Association of University Press. I think that there's a lot of different ways university presses approach business models. A lot of people think of university press publishing programs and their rigorous scholarly work, and that is really the heart of the industry. But most university presses have a blended portfolio, I think as they call it in business, of publishing initiatives. For example, a lot of university presses, alongside their scholarly book programs, have regional trade books. Those are part of their mission to serve readers outside of the academy by supporting histories or knowledge about the region. They also can be income-generating books to help support those books that are really specialized on the scholarly side but may not find the same readership as something of a more popular topic of interest to the community. And beyond book publishing, university presses variably have journals programs, publishing services, and distribution services. There's a variety of ways in which presses have these blended portfolios. Many presses, but not all, have journals programs. These are, I think, of twin pillars alongside the book publishing program. Some presses have huge journals programs. I'm thinking of places like Chicago and Johns Hopkins. Some have large programs. I'm thinking of Illinois and Duke. And others have more modest programs of maybe like a dozen journals. This is the kind of size journals program that Texas had, where I was at before, and that UNC Press, where I'm currently at, has. And some presses don't have a journals program at all, and that's okay. They focus on their books. So just to say that there's a diversity of ways in which this can operate. Some, and not many, but some presses also offer publishing services. This can look like supporting university initiatives, maybe a department or maybe a university that has several campuses. Maybe one campus has a special type of book project that need help with, and it wouldn't really fit in the normal peer review process and publication system that presses have, but because of the in-house expertise a university press has, they can collaborate on a service like that, helping special projects. Several presses also offer distribution services. The big ones are Chicago, the Chicago Distribution Center, Johns Hopkins, the Hopkins Fulfillment Center, and actually UNC Press, who has Longleaf. And so this is a shift we've seen over time from university presses having individual distribution at their own warehouses to more affiliate consortium distribution models, where a few presses have their big distribution networks and arms and their supporting group of presses. I'll also say that the reporting lines across presses can be very different. Two of the presses I've been at were very much units underneath squarely their parent institution. Like the director of the press reported at some point up the umbrella to like a provost or a dean. Other presses have reporting lines to their libraries at universities. Others are affiliate. That happens to be what UNC Press is. And so I hope this speaks to the ways in which there are defining factors of university presses, especially that board, especially peer review is the bedrock of publishing, but they operate in a myriad of different and very fascinating ways.
Thank you. That's great. So Dawn, do you see there being any key differences between books and journals at a university press, just in terms of the workflows or the experience of working in those two different areas?
I do. So I am at the front end of the books process in acquisitions, and I think that looks a little bit different than what the front end of journals work looks like for my journals colleagues. I think one of the similarities is at the core of a lot of this work is relationships. I'm building relationships with authors and networks in a book-oriented way, but I'm always thinking about larger fields. And colleagues in journals are also leveraging different networks and connections. Oftentimes, they're less with individuals and more with organizations or things like that. So when I'm acquiring a book, I am working with an individual author on their process, overseeing the peer review process, and kind of being a liaison between an author and the publishing process all the way through the journey of our first conversation until the book is out. Now, following peer review and following that Board of Governors approval I mentioned earlier, the book moves into production and through the production process to printing. I think the parallels between books and journals publication process are that production and printing process. But from what I'm familiar with in terms of the front end of that journals process, a lot of the journals peer review, so peer review is one of the biggest parts of my job. It takes up a huge amount of my time and it's a very rewarding feature of my job. The peer review process in journals is not often overseen in-house at a publisher. That is something often overseen by the journal editor, which is often at a university department or like a scholarly organization, and they're shepherding the review process. And they have a production coordinator or a coordinator in-house at the publisher. They have a contact in the journals department to oversee questions about the nuts and bolts. But the acquisitions part that would parallel the books is really the acquisitions of a whole journal. And so the acquisitions of a journal then becomes how the journal itself would get published over time, but that peer review process is not often housed within the press, not that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Yes, that is super interesting. It kind of leads into the next question I was going to ask you, which is sort of identifying some of the key differences between a university press and a for-profit publisher. I think you've talked a little bit about that already, but what might be of interest to our audience specifically is kind of what the experience would be like. What would be different about the experience in those two places? Is that something you could speak to?
You know, I get this question from authors sometimes too. So I think it's a great thing to think about. I'll say that being nonprofit is really baked into the mission of much of what we do as university presses. At the end of the day, we're trying to break even, which is a huge difference between university presses and for-profit publishers that, understandably, by their own missions, are trying to make profits. So it means we, as university presses, are usually pricing our specialized books as low as we can to be affordable, even if we know they're not going to break even, because our mission is to disseminate information as broadly as possible. So when we do take on books that are advancing scholarly discussions, even though we might not recuperate the cost of publishing some books, we also know that things like that blended portfolio, like a bigger readership might be attracted to them. We are balancing out the books that don't recuperate their costs versus some that exceed their costs. So overall, we're breaking even. I'd say that I'm most familiar with humanities and social sciences scholarly publishing, and so I wanted to make sure to clarify that. And one of the key differences I see playing out, especially where journals are involved between the university press model and the for-profit model, is how nonprofit university presses and for-profit publishers are handling author rights sometimes to the intellectual property of works. I've worked with authors on their books who have published articles in a journal published by a for-profit press. And when they go to try to build off that intellectual property in their future book, there's been sometimes permissions, hangups, or issues with different policies that for-profit publishers have from nonprofit presses. I haven't found these similar limitations with any of the university presses I've worked with or I'm familiar with. In case of an author going back to their journal where it was published saying, hey, I have a book, I'd like to use some of the same material, it's under a different argument, and this is the press is going to need, say, the ability to distribute this electronically because that's how we publish books these days. And the journal publisher being like, oh, we can't allow that. And the author being like, but it's my work, and these sorts of tensions. So of course, the university press world, we're asking for citations. We're asking for like, hey, let us know what's going on so we can have some documentation of it. But we really have fewer hurdles to scholars using their own work elsewhere. And this is really just tied to our mission. Our mission is to disseminate work as broadly as possible. So that means supporting authors continuing their work in those various sorts of outlets.
Thanks, Dawn, for that answer. And I'm going to kick it over to Sara for our next couple of questions. Sara, over to you.
Thanks, Meredith. And Dawn, it's really, really great to have you with us today. So following on from Meredith's questions, what would a typical day look like for you in your role as an editorial director?
I would say that, and I'm sure you may get this answer from a lot of people you talk with, is that their typicality is that there is no super typical day. But I do feel like my day is defined by a lot of balancing between a certain set of things, and those are personnel management, editorial oversight of the department, fielding process queries and updates within the department and interdepartmentally, and oh yes, my own acquisitions work. So right now I oversee a department of 12 people, including myself. That's 8 editors, 3 assistants, and an acquisitions coordinator. I do have a colleague, executive editor, who oversees a couple of the editors and an assistant. So we're coordinating on those sorts of trajectories within the department. Acquisitions wise, I'm working on 3 series. I'm responsible for acquiring 10 to 15 titles a year. That is nested within the overall editorial program. UNC Press currently publishes about 100 books a year, but we're in a growth phase. And so I'm currently assessing systems and trying to implement new practices that will help facilitate what it will look like in a few years when we have 110 books, 120 books, 130 books. So right now, in any given typical day, I'm reading a book proposal, working on sending peer reviews to an author, reading a manuscript that has already been out for peer review and is going back out as a manuscript, working on contracts, sometimes my own, sometimes helping editors figure out what they can offer terms for the contracts they're offering. I mentioned before that I think a lot of the work with acquisitions and journals and at the root of publishing is relationships. So as editorial director, that maps onto relationships within the department, between departments, and then my usual acquisitions workload of having relationships with series editors and authors and those sorts of things.
It sounds to me that there are many differences to what we would call a normal press, but there's also a lot of similarities. Is that true?
I do think so. I think that university presses are following a lot of the same publication processes and a lot of the same practices. When I talk with colleagues who work outside of university press world, relationships are still at the heart of what they do, doing a lot of in-depth work to developing books and then overseeing the successful publication through it all, whether that looks like negotiating titles, negotiating covers, thinking about how to promote the book once it's out in the world. The marketing teams at university presses are doing the same things as the marketing teams at other presses, leveraging their networks and media, pitching books, going to sales calls, connections with sales reps, sometimes across the world. So yeah, I would say there's a lot of parallels. I would say we're probably more similar than we are different.
Yeah, and I think that will surprise some people, actually. So it's really useful. Thank you. And what do you wish others in the industry knew about the function of the university press?
There is a plethora of models for university press publishing. We all have our standards, best practices. Those are the same. The Association of University Presses is the best resource for determining those sorts of things. One thing I wanted to share about today is I am a member of an editorial collective for a project called Feeding the Elephant, which is part of HNET's book channel. Feeding the Elephant is a forum for conversations about scholarly communications that aims to represent scholars, publishers, and library perspectives, primarily focusing on the humanities. And one of our co-founders, Catherine Cox, the director of Syracuse University Press, has developed an incredible series for the blog on varieties of scholarly publishing models. And these include examples of an array of publishing models. It includes US-based presses, international presses. There are pieces about consortia publishing. One university press is kind of the host of multiple university press imprints under it. University department publishing, which is one of the ones I talked about where there's a unit in university press publishing that kind of has a direct line to a dean or a provost. Independent nonprofit publishing, a little bit adjacent to what I said UNC Press is as an affiliate, a little bit more autonomy. There's a piece on open access publishing. One piece is from the director of the University of Guam Press, which talks about their community-based publishing mission and operations. And so this Feeding the Elephant series is truly the best resource I'm aware of for reading about the diversity of publishing models and approaches in the university press world, and probably would cover way more terrain than I could cover in our conversation today. So I highly recommend it, even though I'm a bit biased being involved with Feeding the Elephant.
Dawn, thanks so much for talking about Feeding the Elephant. It sounds like a fantastic resource, and we'll put the link to that with the link for the episode. My next question for you, Dawn, is what advice would you give someone who's curious about getting into the university press world? Can you describe some of the entry-level roles new early career professionals could seek out?
I would love to. As someone who really loves being a part of the university press professional community, I am aware that, like every industry, it has its flaws, but I found it a really rewarding place to work, both personally, professionally, intellectually. One of the best resources I could direct people to is a document assembled by Amy Sherman, an acquiring editor at University of Pittsburgh. She has a comprehensive career in publishing resource doc. You can find her on social media with the handle at @endcleverness. She has links posted to this document, at least on Blue Sky. She might also still be on X, but this is a really foundational document for people interested in entering university press world, and I highly recommend it. There is also an amazing initiative. It's a free mentorship program called Paths in Publishing. This was founded by Rachel LeVay and Allegro Marchenko, who are both currently at Princeton University Press. Paths in Publishing has a newsletter, a podcast, a book club called Pages. But what I think is the coolest feature of Paths in Publishing is they have an open inbox on their website where people can submit a cover letter and resume for review. They also offer mock interviews. So Paths in Publishing will pair people who have shared their resume and CV with a mentor to kind of review it and give advice and feedback before they send out applications. So this is like unimaginable when I entered the industry. You go to your mentor and you're like, will you read this? So the way that this helps open up Paths in Publishing, from my perspective, is people who don't already have an inroad or mentor within university press world. Well, there is one now reaching out to Paths in Publishing. If people are interested in getting into the university press world, I also recommend looking at the Association of University Presses job board often. University presses are posting there reliably and regularly, and you can get a good sense of what a typical job description is for certain roles and what kind of early career roles are available. There are going to be entry-level positions in every facet of publishing, whether it's marketing, editorial design and production, journals, or acquisitions. Some of the entry-level roles are going to be your basic administrative work, let's say, doing support work for other people in those departments. So entering with the idea that a lot of how people see the roles in publishing are as apprentice-like, the idea of learning by doing and then the professional mobility, hopefully, to follow. I think that going to these resources, Amy Sherman's list, Paths in Publishing, and the University Press Job Board are such strong foundations to learn about what resources you have and stay in the loop on the tops of university press or scholarly publishing conversations is probably one of the best ways I can lay a foundation for that.
Thanks, Dawn. And what we'll also do is, given that you've referenced a couple of different resources or websites that people can go to, we'll also make sure we include those links along with the episode. And finally, what's the one piece of advice you'd like to share from your own career?
Well, I think I have two, but I'll keep the second one brief. One is, I think we can all really get caught up in hustle culture. And I think something I personally learned the hard way is that your work-life balance and how good you are at that can also be a metric of success. And one of the ways in which I've tried to be more successful at this work-life balance is thinking about no as its own opportunity. And by that, I mean, sometimes saying no to something can be just as big of an opportunity as saying yes. A well-thought no, whether it is an acquisitions project you have under consideration or a service opportunity or even a job you've been offered, sometimes leaves time and space for a yes to something else. And sometimes that yes is for yourself, and that's okay too, making time for self-care in an industry that, you know, can sometimes lead to burnout pretty quickly. That yes to yourself is an opportunity in itself, but also saying no sometimes means that you can say yes to something that comes along later that you would have been too overscheduled to do if you had said yes to the original thing. And the second piece of advice I could not resist also saying is, I think we all need to normalize talking about career progression, talking about salary, talking about title changes. This should be a normal, healthy part of your dynamic with your manager. And no one is going to advocate better for you than you will advocate for yourself.
Thank you so much, Dawn. You've been an outstanding guest. I personally, myself, for all of my years in publishing and associated fields, learned an enormous amount today. So I really appreciate it. For me, just a couple of takeouts that I just want to end with is what I just found really interesting is that there are so many differences, but there are also similarities, so many similarities in the publishing world. And I think this is another opportunity for people to explore. And going back to what you just said at the end there in terms of career advice, I think it's so important to have those conversations to talk about career advancement. So thank you so much, because I think that's really, really relevant for the people who are listening to this podcast who are early career professionals. So thank you so much for being a wonderful guest. Thank you, SSP, so much for hosting this, and to all of you who listen. And we'll see you on the podcast next time.
Thank you.